Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 193 on how to rehab a house the right way with Van Sturgeon. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high-caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars or more in the business of real estate. Today's guest, Van Sturgeon, personally owns more than 1,000 rental properties throughout the U.S. and Canada. He's rehabbed even more, picking up countless methods along the way. Rehabbing houses is a breeze for highly successful real estate investors. Buying property cheap due to the condition, then renovating those properties to force value is one of the most powerful methods for compounding wealth. The skill of rehabbing is crucial to the BRRRR method, you know, the buy, renovate, rent, and refi strategy, used to build a large portfolio using a limited amount of capital. During this episode, Van and I will dive deep into the renovation aspect of the real estate business, along with other topics such as large multifamily investing and market selection. Let's begin. All right, Van Sturgeon, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. I've been looking forward to this actual podcast for a while. I'm a great fan of yours. I've listened to a bunch of stuff that you put out there. Wonderful, great content. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, appreciate it. And the feeling is mutual. Like when we on the podcast, the booking agents kind of, alert me to certain guests, and some guests just quite frankly don't make the cut. I don't think it's going to be a good fit for us, for the audience, et cetera. And then others, I'm, you know, wildly excited when I do a little background research, do the Google and get the story. And you're one I've been looking forward to as well to get on the schedule here. So I'm happy to be here and glad we could find the time. So, Van, do you want to kind of fill us in on the background story, kind of where you came from and what led up to what you're doing today?
Sure. Well, I'm a product of the 60s and the 70s, you know, flower power, the bell bottoms and that kind of thing. And I grew up in the city of Chicago. And my parents, we lived in an apartment, one bedroom apartment with my younger brother. And my parents were immigrants to the country and were looking to save up their money to eventually run out and buy their first home, to live out the American dream. And as they're putting their shekels together, putting their money together, they discovered, I don't know how, that the apartment building they were actually living in had gone up for sale. And instead of buying that dream home, they decided to become landlords. So they put all their monies together, borrowed some from friends and family, and actually went in and they purchased this property and became landlords. And that happened in the late 70s, where just at the cusp of that, you're too young to remember, Dan, it was a miserable time back then with interest rates skyrocketing 18, 20%, the Iran hostage situation, the economy was miserable. And what we began to see, this beautiful neighborhood that we were living in, Chicago, all of a sudden, started to deteriorate and deteriorate pretty rapidly. Drugs started to come in. People were starting to leave. And it got to a point where this building that was beautiful, fully occupied, all of a sudden was suffering 40, 50, 60% vacancy. It got really bad, really quickly. And the neighborhood started to change where you had these beautiful apartment buildings that we were surrounded by. All of a sudden, one, two, three, five, all of a sudden would get torched. Wow. Meaning that they were actually landlords running around, you know, got out of desperation to collect insurance money, would actually literally torch their buildings. And so it was in that environment where we got into that. It got bad. And so as a family, we had to buckle down. We had to do everything that possible to save this investment. And so we literally did everything that you can think of to keep that building up and running, meaning, you know, whether it's fixing the roof, replacing windows, cleaning toilets, painting, plaster, whatever it required, carpeting, removal, whatever we had to do as a family, we did it all our own. We couldn't afford to hire experts. We couldn't afford to hire electricians and plumbers and painters. So it's from that background that I got from doing all of this at a young age, is where We went, got through that period, the difficult period of time. Things progressively got better. Went off to university, graduated, had an opportunity to go off and become a lawyer, got accepted to several law schools, but my heart wasn't in it. And I had a very difficult conversation with my parents saying, hey, I just don't want to do this. I don't see myself being a lawyer. I really enjoy real estate. I really enjoy being a general contractor. And so that's where they begrudgingly gave their approval. And I went off in Chicago and became a general contractor. And so I started knocking on doors, started to network, started to create relationships with individuals and trying to grow this business. And thankfully, during the early 90s was a good period of time. And I started to get more and more busy. And one of the things I kept running into were these career real estate investors, people that this was their main business, whether they were buying and flipping properties or buying and adding them to their portfolio. And started to network with these people, started to see what these people were doing. And then I got around to actually doing it myself. And so the first property I remember, like it was yesterday, I purchased it for $43,000 or $44,000, something like that. It was a real beat up little bungalow. I still have some decrepit little photographs of it for what I did to it. And because I was so proud of it, I bought it, I renovated it, and several months later, it cost me around $17,000-$18,000 at the time to renovate. And I put it up for sale and I sold it for $90,000+. All in all, I made $30,000. And at that time in 1991, to make $30,000, that was a heck of a lot of beans.
Good deal.
Because the average salary was around $25,000, $30,000. And I made that in four or five months. So I immediately got hooked on it. And I was like, wow, this is something that I wanted to do. So it was sort of, it ran in parallel. I was growing this general contracting business and at the same time doing flips on the side and growing that side of the business. And I've been very lucky and fortunate in my life in that through real estate, I've been able to create a number of successful businesses where I've built subdivisions, custom homes to a real estate developer. I own a property management companies and do also restoration work on commercial high-rise buildings. So I've done everything that you can think of under the sun, and I've been truly, truly blessed to the point where I've got over 1,000 properties across North America that I look after and that I collect income from. So it's been a great ride.
Nice. It sounds like a great ride. I want to talk before we get into the rehabbing stuff and the how to's, which I know the audience is going to be looking forward to. But you mentioned being in a couple different markets. I'm curious how you made the progression, because I did make the progression and my audience is probably aware. We're in Atlanta. We're in Phoenix now. We're in Chicago. I grew up in Philadelphia and I ended up in all these markets because I moved from Philadelphia to Chicago so I could be near my daughter. And that led to expanding to different marketplaces. So I'm curious, what was the catalyst for you? How did you make that decision? What led to you being in which markets? And maybe you could talk about, as a part of that, what your process for selecting these markets has been or is.
Sure. That's a great question. So originally, because I started off in Chicago and just because that's where I was born and raised. When I went off to university, I went to university in Toronto. And I've got a lot of family and friends and all that good stuff. And I got a history because of, you know, going up there to go to school. And so, and that's where eventually my lovely, lovely, beautiful wife, thank goodness that I met a wonderful soul. So she being a Canadian kind of made me or kind of helped me transition out of Chicago and go to Toronto. And that's where in the late 90s is where I branched off to. But one of the things that I quickly discovered was that Toronto or the province of Ontario is very landlord not friendly. And as a result, it was such a stark contrast between Toronto in comparison to the state of Illinois or Chicago, that whatever investments I made, it really kind of quickly, very quickly, I realized that this is not a good move. You know, we make mistakes, we learn from them. So on the construction renovation side, I had active and thriving businesses. I still have a restoration company up in Toronto that's doing very well, like commercial restoration work. But I then decided that this is not the place for me. So I transitioned to other markets. So one of the things that I'm very passionate about is landlord-friendly areas of that they're across North America. that you can identify, but I'm also a real big proponent of cash flow. I love finding investments where the arithmetic says that it's a winner, and that gives you an opportunity to be able to sleep well at night. There's so many investments that I find across North America where places like San Francisco and Vancouver, Toronto, Miami, you know, a lot of New York, you know, there's a lot of places out there that they are so cap compressed. It's so difficult to be able to be positive cash flow, never mind achieving any cash flow. That's not something that I'm an advocate for. Nevertheless, though, people that do dabble in those markets see huge appreciation property value. So it's a matter of what stirs your boat or floats your boat. I'm a cash flow guy, and that's what I've been concentrating on. So as a result, you'll find me in markets like in Michigan, Detroit area, of Cleveland, Ohio, great places. I've been there for years. Up in Canada, New Brunswick is a province. There's a number of places over there where cash flow is, the numbers make sense. And also in Florida, I've been in the Tampa area. I have a number of investments over there that made sense. Now, Florida is starting to get more difficult, but nevertheless, those are the four areas that I've concentrated my investments in.
So let's just dive a little deeper into the example, Detroit or Cleveland, let's say. You decided to go in there. Is there a specific model? Maybe I'm buying 10 with cash, doing a refinance, getting some cash out, moving on. Is it just buying them cash, wait until I have cash flow, buy another one? What was kind of the entry like in the plan going in, if you had any?
The numbers made so much sense that what I would end up doing is what you identified first. I would accumulate a portfolio cash. I would just cash. I would buy $30,000 to $50,000 properties that required some work that needed a tenant, and the cash flow was there. Once I put a portfolio of properties together, then I would. There was lots of people that were interested in providing financing on that. It's very difficult to find for one individual properties to find financing that on that $50,000 to $70,000 property. You need to be up there up to the $120,000 to $150,000 for a financial institution to come in. But if you package portfolios together, there are definitely the investors out there, institutions that are willing to put up the money. So I would kill two birds with one stone. I would buy low, and also I would buy properties that had issues in terms of needing to require some rehabbing, some renovation. And then after that, I would go get them after 6 months, 2 years seasoning. Then I would go out there and get them financed and then move on to the next portfolio. Also, there's opportunities of buying portfolios. They still exist to this day. But back then, there was other cats who were out there doing the same thing that got to know in those areas, in those industries, and I mean, in those areas, and was able to create opportunities or win-win situations where I was able to acquire properties that way as well.
Nice. Appreciate you filling in the holes on that piece of the strategy there. So do you still rehab houses today? You're still pretty active, or is now pretty much a different focus for you?
No, we get opportunities that come about through the power teams that we've created, these networks that we create in these areas. So we get on a daily basis, we get opportunities that we look at. Now, whether we actually act on them or not is a different story, but we get opportunities. So we never go out on MLS to try to find an opportunity. I can't even remember that last time that I've actually gone on it. So as a result, we are still active and we try to find opportunities. And those opportunities, 99% of the time, Dan, as you well know, require a little sprinkling of some money and effort. So, you know, we've got to roll up the sleeves. So whether it's a multifamily where it's a you need to raise rents as a turnaround situation. Also, if there's opportunities, a single family, like I can dabble in either spectrum because of the people that I have in place. So I like larger portfolios. I like to be able to purchase a 48, 62, 120 unit kind of a property, like a multifamily property. But you're finding those are more difficult to come across nowadays as prior to, you know, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, because there's an endless search for return on investment, ROI. And so the big boys, you know, up in those investment funds and, you know, family offices have gone into the market, and they keep sticking their toe further and further down where, you know, 5 years ago, you wouldn't find them chasing after 100 unit, 48 unit apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. Now they're dabbling in those. And so now you got to look at it as a contrarian. And that's one of the things that I'm blessed with, that I have that mixture of portfolio where I have single family as well as multifamily, where I see that there's more opportunity. If I really want to get in there and accumulate more in my portfolio, I see more of an opportunity on the single family side than I do on multifamily, because the big boys, because out of desperation, they've come down and made it really more competitive for us to be able to find the deal, if that makes sense. I don't know if you've encountered that or in the guests that you brought on, that this is becoming more and more difficult because the big boys have come down and trying to dabble. They're getting into the areas that they never used to be.
It does. And I have done research all the way back to like the 50s as far as economic trends and real estate and the markets going up and down, and kind of overlaying that with demographic data. And I'm curious, right? I have this kind of going back and forth in my mind. Is it like we're having this like real estate market cycle that we're currently in, or is this like a longer, broader? So like Warren Buffett was buying, I think, a lot of his stocks back in the 50s and 60s at like 8-9 PE ratio. And yep. I think the average for the whole market is something like 16, 18. It's like, it's much higher. And there's like, you know, 30s and 40s and like crazy PE multiples, to your point of dollars chasing the ROI. And so I feel like there's this longer term trend of smaller and smaller returns happening. And then also perhaps it's the institutionalization of American real estate. So I don't know the exact numbers in London, but I've had friends who say London doesn't work like Toronto doesn't work if you're buying for cash flow. And it's like, maybe there's institutional money who operate and buy things and get minuscule return on investment, which us entrepreneurial folk like you and I and everyone listening would find completely unacceptable and too risky. And it's like, geez, to your point of buying the single families and seeing that opportunity to still collect assets at some level, like you can't really do that as much in the city of Atlanta like you could, let's say, 5 years ago. And that's a result of institutional dollars pouring in. Some of the same phenomenon is going on in Phoenix, Arizona. You got institutional dollars pouring in, plus California dollars pouring in. And everyone is doing this appreciation play game. It's like they're bidding up the properties as if they're Bitcoin, or at least certainly a few weeks ago. So it's, you know, in my mind, it's like, are we sitting on the sidelines waiting for better buying opportunities, right? But missing out on the current gains and like the better buying opportunities that most of us now have this frame of reference from 2009, 10, 11. And we're like, wow, we could go back. But that was like a once in 100 year type of a buying scenario. And I don't think we're going to see anything quite to that level, certainly anytime in the next decade, you know?
Dan, all I can say is I totally agree with everything you said. And the jury's still out. We don't know. Like, who would have thought that in 2004, 5, we would have seen what we saw in 2007, 8, 9, how the real estate market collapsed. What I could strongly encourage everybody, all your listeners, is that you prepare for the worst and you hope for the best. And if the numbers make sense, they make sense. And they don't, they don't. There are deals that be had every single day. And you need to get out there and don't be discouraged. There are opportunities that exist. They can exist down the street, two blocks down, where there's an opportunity through somebody that you get to meet and find an opportunity. They do exist. With regards to what you just still outlined, I totally agree, because what's happening is a lot of these pension plans are forced to, or they're mandated to have X amount of return on investment. And so as a result, they got to get out there, and they're not allowed to go on the stock market because it's considered speculative. So they got to go out there and grab real estate. And I've seen cap rates at 2-3% where you scratch your head and you know the numbers are juiced. You're scratching your head at 2-3% cap rates. You're saying there's no way that this guy, whoever buys it, this entity can buy it, can make, you know, can turn this operation to a black. And I see it all the time. But yet it's been happening over the last number of years. And we're just seeing cap rates getting compressed and compressed. So, you know, in those types of situations, I mentioned, you got to look at it in terms of a contrarian. So that's why I have a mixture of single family and also the multifamily. So whenever an opportunity comes about that makes sense, numbers make sense, then I'm going out there and grabbing it. And it may very well be that we, as you know, private little investors, need to look at that and try to be more nimble. And I strongly advocate that. We all know about all these syndicators are running around chasing deals, but I don't know if the numbers make sense. They don't make sense. A lot of them don't make sense to me. And so God bless them. I wish them best of luck and success. I don't wish anybody ill will. I hope they become successful. But at the same time, we're entering very uncharted water. Because one of the things that we also got to think about is that the influx of money is unprecedented that the government has thrown out there. And we are seeing it all around us in terms of inflation. And so inflation drives down cap rates because the cost of money is so much easier to be able to borrow and go. But eventually there's going to be a change in that. And when that change occurs, and it will happen, I don't know what's going to end up. Something's going to happen because we've got such an extreme on one hand of money being printed and being thrown out there that's inflationary. But then again, we have interest rates at historic lows. So something's got to give. And when that gives, I don't know. And you can make an argument that says the sky's going to fall, but also at the same time, you can make an argument that, hey, it's just going to keep going and going. I don't know what the answer is. All I do is I look at each individual opportunity, assess it, do the arithmetic, and it should tell you, it should guide you in the right direction. And again, for those individuals that run out on MLS or LoopNet to try to find deals, there are no deals there. You got to get out there. You got to roll up your sleeve. Like, you know what I'm talking about, Dan. You got to get out there in the marketplace. You got to knock on doors. You got to network. You got to find the off-market deal, whether it's on single family or multifamily. And ultimately, there are deals out there. You just got to find them. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but yeah.
Yeah, and it does. And I mean, to your point, the deal's still being out there, Van. Like, I think of the city of Chicago where I live now. And a lot of investors, when I moved here in 2015, they were buying on the north side. They were buying and flipping houses in Arlington Heights, the suburbs, you know, $300,000, $400,000, $250,000, buying them for $150,000, $200,000. And it's really rare that we see any deals come through in that type of area with the low inventory. However, the entire south side, I mean, we had a deal. The mayor of Robbins, Illinois has had they're selling the vision of Robbins, Illinois coming back. And we could not sell a house in that area. You couldn't give 10 grand, 12 grand. It was a pass. Same house is 50, 60,000 now. Someone can renovate it. Someone can sell it to someone who's going to live there and have a fully renovated house for $150,000, $170,000, $180,000. That's a good investment for the right person to get into that house. So I think it's good what we're seeing with some of this housing shortage that we're currently in. It's starting to drive investment into neighborhoods that did not see it over the past few years. So I think it's a good thing. And there's areas in Philadelphia, and it's also kind of areas in Atlanta that are operating just the same. And I haven't been in Phoenix long enough to figure out if there's any of them there or not yet. But to your point, you know, one of the things I'm on all kinds of like wholesalers lists, and the wholesalers still have decent opportunities. You'll be worn out having to check the email and see if it's sure. Fit. Is it in your area? But you know, they still exist. I mean, they still exist to get deals in this marketplace. Well, let's switch gears now and talk a little bit about rehabbing. So you sure. Are the rehab guy, Van, the rehab man. We have him here on the show. Let's talk about kind of what your current passion and purpose is with helping investors, and then we'll start doing some how-to rehab stuff if we could.
Sure. Well, the reason why I got off on this journey was that, like as I mentioned, I've had a pretty fabulous but also rough life. I've taken my family through a lot. I've slept on job sites. I've done whatever it's taken to succeed, and I've been very fortunate and lucky. But I wanted to downshift on my life, and I'm sort of semi-retired right now. But at the same time, I became bored, and I'm not the kind of guy that goes golfing every day or grabs a block of wood and starts whittling it and turning it into a coffee table. So I've been struggling to figure out what the heck am I going to do with the rest of my life, because I'm not that old, but at the same time I'm old and I want to relax. And I get a phone call from a friend of mine who's interested in doing a renovation to their house, a rehab. And like I've been doing over the last 30 years, I've helped friends, family, neighbors out, and so I helped them through the planning and management of the renovation, where they didn't hire a general contractor, they did it themselves. And so after the whole experience, I enjoyed it. I was thoroughly enthralled by it and how I helped them out, how I empowered these people, and they saved a lot of money. They were so thankful. And after that, I talking to a fellow real estate investor, a friend of mine who was also a coach. I talked to him about the experience. He's like, yeah, you would be surprised at how many people are so fearful, and it's understandable, but fearful of doing this rehab and renovation. And that there's an actual need for somebody out there to be able to help people, through the planning and execution of it, where if you act on it, not only do you save a lot of money then, but you also learn a skill set that you can then apply and use for the rest of your life as you build a successful real estate portfolio. And whenever we try to acquire a property, whenever we're acquiring a property, we're acquiring an ugly duckling. We're acquiring a property that's a diamond in a rough that needs some work in order to be able to raise value. And so as a result, if you don't, you need to have that skill set, because especially nowadays, when you walk into a property, you only have a couple hours sometimes to make a deal. And if you don't, if you're not able to go out there and do an immediate assessment of what the costs are and the time associated with renovating that place, you're going to, you can't call your property inspector, because that property inspector will take hours or days to show up and all that kind of stuff, right? So you need to be able to have that skill set. And so that's what embarked me on this journey. And I really enjoy interacting with people, especially new real estate investors. And I help them overcome their fear of you know, planning and managing a renovation. So it's been great. And I enjoy the process.
Nice. Yeah, I take it for granted. I kind of have a background like you, not quite exactly, but my dad was renovating houses. And like my first, one of my first toys that I can like remember, when I was like 5 or 6, my dad let me have like a 2-foot piece of 12-2 wire and like some strippers and a razor knife. I don't know what the hell he was thinking for giving a 5-year-old a razor knife. And I would like wire this outlet and this plug for fun, you know, a little electrical box. And that was something that I do. I had like a bag of this like random stuff. And I grew up on the job site sweeping and, you know, kind of handing them tools and figuring stuff out. And that gave me a level of comfort being around the construction sites and things of that nature growing up. That when I started rehab and I kind of just, all right, well, we're going to figure this piece out. We're going to figure that piece out. And it was sort of logical because I'd like known the language of rehab and like you, but wow. Yeah. Like when I see people who get into the business and they did not have any, you know, any of that experience whatsoever, I commend that person when they embrace it, you know, husband, wife, team coming from corporate job, they're accountants, and now they're going to do this. Yeah, well done. But leaning on someone like yourself could be a really, really strong asset for someone like that to overcome the fear and get into the business. What would you say is the correct process if there were a do this, 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 and this for rehabbing a house, if we were going to give some bullet points for the listeners?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I strongly encourage, and I'm a big proponent on, not only on doing a reno, but anything that you take on in life, is that you need to create a goal. And that goal ultimately has got to be, what is it that you're looking to accomplish with this particular renovation or this particular project, this particular property? And that should be it should be written down. It should be staring at you every morning when you wake up, because is everything that you plan out and you execute is to follow through on that particular goal. So the goal can vary depending on the particular properties. It could be that this property you're looking to rent it out and make $1,200 a month. That's a goal. Write it down. Or it could be that I'm looking to flip this property and make $60,000 in profit. That's a goal. Write it down. And then once you have it written down, you got to visualize, and you can then move on to the planning aspect of the actual renovation itself, or rehab, some people call. And what that is that you need to grab that goal, and you need to first run out and validate that. So that what that requires is going out in the marketplace and determining if that truly is what your goal is, of $1,200 to get per month, or selling it for $60,000 profit. What are the comparables out there in the marketplace to be able to make sure that you can achieve that goal? Oftentimes, I see people running into things, situations where they think they coulda, shoulda, woulda, but they don't actually have a firm idea of what it is that they're looking to accomplish and validating it. So once you get through that process of actually truly understanding your market, understanding what it is you have, the next thing is that you need to figure out budget, money, the money aspect. And so it's either money, cash on hand, whether it's a line of credit, whether it's hard money lenders. There's a variety of places. There's even areas around North America where government actually can step in, provide some dollars in terms of renovations or rehabbing certain things in on your particular home. You got to figure all that out. Once you've got all of that, then the next step is you got to go through the property and literally create a needs and wants list. And what that means is a need is something that has to be accomplished, something that has to be done. So if you got a gaping hole in the roof, if you got squirrels running around through your attic, these are things that you need to address immediately, no matter what. Wants are things that, you know, perhaps a bluish kind of shaggy carpet from the 70s, although it's ugly to look at, it might be still functional. That's put under the category of a want. If there's money in the budget to replace that, you go ahead maybe perhaps in doing that. But if you don't have the money and you address everything that's on your needs side, then you go look after the wants. And a lot of times I find new real estate investors just think that, you know, if the windows are 40, 60 years old, that, you know, naturally you have to replace them. Well, in many rehabs that I do, renovations, I don't necessarily, unless there's money in the budget, do anything with the windows. I leave them where they are. As long as they're functional, they're not letting drafts in, I leave them alone. And I always am a big proponent of leaving some money on the table. Then a lot of people think that they're going to see the market value of an area of being, let's say, $250,000, and they want to list their property and sell it for $250,000. I don't believe in that. I believe in that moving product, selling, maximizing the opportunity, moving on to the next project. So if I'm in that situation where the market value is $250,000, I'm going to put the list of property at $230-ish, $240-ish maybe. I want to draw in offers. I want to make a deal quickly so I can move on to the next project. And so that's the reason why the blue carpeting, the windows, things of that sort, I might not on a cosmetic side address just so that I can price the property a little bit lower and let the other person come in who wants to buy the property feel like they got a deal. There hasn't been a deal. Dan, you're going to agree with me. There hasn't been a deal where every party didn't feel that they got a deal out of it, that they were able to find value in it. Every transaction, every party feels that they got some value. So I've always tried to create situations where people, when they walk in, they're foaming at the bit. They want to buy the property because they feel that's a deal. That's the best situation to create, a win-win where you're profiting, you're moving product, and you create an opportunity for that individual. So once you've kind of been able to create that needs list and you got an understanding of the whole situation there, the next thing, which is the most important thing that I find that doesn't happen on the residential side, is a document called the scope of work. Now, if you come from a commercial side, I'm a general contractor. I work on commercial as well as residential, everything that walks and crawls. On the commercial side, when you're looking at a rehabbing an office space or apartment building, an underground garage, you will have architects, engineers, interior designers involved in the process, and they create a document. And once that inside that document, all the specifications, all the drawings, all the things associated with that renovation rehab are included in that document. And there are subsections within that document of disciplines, the electrician, the plumber, the painter. Everybody has their own little section of what work is required on that particular project. So that when I, as a general contractor, or I, as a tradesperson, gets that document, we go through that section and we price it out. In the residential side, I never, hardly ever see that's the case. I don't see that unless you get an interior designer or architect involved. Most new real estate investors, or just real estate investors in general, won't go through a process of itemizing, writing it on paper, what they're looking for, what they're looking to accomplish within that renovation. And as a result, because you don't have it in writing, all of a sudden, how are you possibly going to be able to get competitive quotes? Just because you just point out a property and you assume that the contractor or the tradesperson knows what you have rolling around in your head, or just calling a general contractor up and saying, hey, I want my place renovated. How much is it going to cost? Like, those are the types of silly questions that I come across in dealing with individuals, as well as tradespeople get frustrated, scratching their head to get this phone call that, hey, I want to fix the electricity in my place, or I want to paint these walls without any, you know how many different types of paint there are? How many different qualities, how many different finishes, how many different, there's just different stuff. And if you don't go to the extent of itemizing what it is that you're looking to accomplish within your property, within this renovation rehab, what do you think that painter is going to quote? He's going to quote you the cheapest, lowest quality thing that he can find, because ultimately at the end of the day, he knows that you're taking his price and compare with other painters. And guess what? The other painters are doing the same thing too. But you might have had this illusion or this idea that you want this particular type of paint color, sheen, quality, that if you don't write it down, how's that painter going to know? How's that electrician going to know? How's, you know, all those trades? So a scope of work is one of the fundamental things that I preach, that I found is a huge deficiency out there in the rental rehab land. And, you know, the funny thing is we've got these channels that are dedicated to renovation and rehabbing, you know, HGTV, these renovation DIY disaster mumbo jumbo. And none of them talk about this. None of them talk about this. And it's such a fallacy. And it really pains me, because I, every single day, whether it's from the internet, whether it's from the associates that I have out there in the business and industry, there are horror stories every single day of people you know, just recently somebody, you know, family negotiated a price. They got different quotes to knock their garage down, build it. They settle on a contractor. The contractor demands a deposit, all this money up front. The family gives their money. Then the garage gets knocked down. And all of a sudden, halfway through, the contractor realized that they underbid. There's not enough money in it for them. So they go to the homeowner and say, hey, we need more money. And the homeowner's like, well, I don't have any more money. This is all I budgeted. And the contractor says, well, if you don't have any more money, I'm just going to leave. And that's what they did. They hopped in her truck and they drove off. And so now you got a family who's given up all this money, has disappeared. Good luck trying to track them down. You got a garage that's down, you know, that's reduced to rubble. And now they got to figure out now they, what are they going to do? They got to go reach out to another contractor, other trace people. And if I'm a trace person that got reached out to, what am I going to say? I'm going to go to that particular project and wonder, what's going on here? What happened? Like, am I going to be as enthusiastic to price this up? Because maybe this guy's not paying. Maybe this homeowner, maybe he's got a screw loose. So these are all the things that happen in out there in the real world. Unfortunately, TV and Hollywood, you know, 30 minutes will walk you through a whole reno rehab in 30 minutes. And that isn't quite the case. There's processes and plans and techniques and systems you got to implement. And that's what I teach.
Gotcha. And after the scope of work comes the putting it out to bid. Is that kind of what would be?
That's right. That's right. You would go out there to tender it. Now, one of the things that a lot of people ask me is, how do I find good qualified tradespeople, contractors? And it's very simple for me. And if you're a new real estate investor, one of the things you should be doing already fundamentally is that you need to be a part of associations. You need to be part of your local REI. You need to be part of these meetup groups. It's big. Technology has been so remarkable. I didn't have any of those kind of resources back 30 some odd years ago. You know, the internet's it's a phenomenal piece of machinery. The only thing is that you got to be careful. There's a lot of disinformation out there, but there's a lot of information like your podcast and others that is out there to get content information. But part of the finding contractors, good qualified trace people, is look within your internal networks of, you know, the accountants, the lawyers, the real estate agents, who family members who might have had interactions with good qualified trace people. And then you reach out to your community where, you know, I've been a part of RI groups all over the place. And one of the things I've always found is that people are helpful. People, like, I genuinely want to help people. And if somebody were to come up to me and ask me, hey, do you know of a good electrician? I would give you four. If you're looking for a painter, because that's my business and I want to help people. And I find that a lot of people are like that. So being part of those associations should help you finding those good, legitimate trace people. And you need to find good, legitimate trace people, because what ends up happening, and I've been a victim of it, you learn difficulty, because the temptation is so difficult to resist. Then, you know, when you price out four or five electricians give you a quote, or four or five tile guys give you quotes, the temptation is so difficult to overcome to not go to the cheapest guy. But oftentimes that's a mistake, because what ends up happening is you go for that. You touch that stove that's really hot. You go for that guy that's the cheapest guy. And what ends up happening is he installs those tiles or does some electrical work is totally horrible. It's going to cost you 3 to 5 times more money to rip it all out. You got to pay the guy because you don't want to lien your property. You destroyed all the material that he laid down. You got to rip that all out. And you got to start all over again, which ends up costing 3 to 5 times as much. So I always like to defer when I'm finding contractors, when in the tendering process, to try to get as much references or relationships that those contractors have with people that I trust. And then you got to get out there and you got to actually vet them. So you got to visit job sites. You got to talk to the principals. You got to do your homework. This is serious stuff. This is not, we're not dealing with a couple hundred dollars here. We're dealing literally with tens of thousands of dollars. And sometimes we're dealing with the livelihoods of some people, because I've seen some horror stories where contractors, tradespeople that don't know what they're doing will cut out load-bearing walls in the infrastructure, and all of a sudden the house is dangling, ready to fall in on itself. Hmm. And unfortunately, there isn't a license that's required for anybody to go run out and buy a hammer at your local home improvement center. Everybody can go run out and buy a hammer. And unfortunately, maybe the government should get involved in that and license that too. Because there's a lot of jokers out there, especially right now with this real estate market as heated as it is, you're pulling out a lot of riffraff that want to get in on the action. You know, a lot of contractors, all they got to do is just buy a hammer and a beat up pickup truck, and they're bona fide contractors all of a sudden.
Yeah, we have two strategies that we'll use on occasion for finding contractors. So one is if I'm looking for contractors that work in a specific part of the city. So like in Chicago, your south side and north side contractors may be two different completely organizations and won't go to the other because it's an hour long through traffic. So one of the things that you could do is you could take a look at the recent cash sales in the neighborhood. So I could pull like a 0.3 or 0.5 radius in the MLS, pull up the cash sales that closed in the last like 60 to 90 days, note them, and then drive by the neighborhood, right? Make a list of them and then drive by the neighborhood and see. Usually they're bought by renovation, you know, investors just like us, and the contractors working for those are also reasonably priced and hopefully reasonable amount of construction. And when you approach them, you're kind of using your litmus test. Is this guy an asshole when I come up on the job?
Sure.
Is a guy trying me on? I don't just like trot right out that, hey, I'm Dan Breslin and we did 283, you know, house flips last year. I kind of want to play my cards cool and kind of get a feel for the person if I wanted to do business with them. Were they warm and welcoming or were they not? And the other angle similar to that would be to find, like, let's say completely renovated houses that sold in the area, plentiful in the south side of Chicago, not so plentiful depending on the suburbs that you're in. You may have to go out 2 miles, 3 miles, 4 miles. But if you look through public record and it was bought, you know, within a year or two at a significantly lower price and then sold at retail, completely flipped, you might be able to go down to the office and look through the permits and get the names of the contractors off of the permits and kind of collect it that way. Like in Chicago, we're spoiled. I have the ability to kind of look up new construction permits and pull the every type of contractor that I want right off of this public site that I have that I pay a subscription fee to. That may not be as easy in certain cities with smaller municipalities where they're pulling permits as it would be in a big city. So it's kind of two other ways to find contractors. No,
hey, those are all great points. And it's amazing what people can do if they're industrious and work hard at it. There's opportunities being able to, you just got to figure it out in your area, but good, decent contractors, tradespeople do exist. Unfortunately, there's a huge stigma that's placed on them because of a few bad apples. And right now, unfortunately, there's more bad apples that have come out of the woodwork. But nevertheless, if you follow the system, follow the process, vet them, and like what I've outlined, especially if you have a creative scope of work, then when you have a document, it weeds out the riffraff. Because when you provide this document you tender it out to four or five electricians, if they're not bona fide operators, they won't bid on it. They'll just run away. Bona fide legitimate operators will look at it and actually be thankful and want to quote on a job. And that's where I come from as a legitimate quality contractor, is that I always wanted to deal with principals that knew what the heck they were wanting to do and weren't wishy-washy. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, for me, making money was a quick turnaround on the project. So whether I GC'd it, I want to be able to go in, bang it out, and go get my money and move on to the next project. And I never like projects where there's humming and hawing and construction delays, because it just ended up costing money. Yeah, time is money. So that's one of the things that getting a scope of work will do amazing to being able to identify quality people to do work for you.
Gotcha. So one of the things I was checking out before the show was your Facebook page, and I enjoy seeing these different tips. Things to do, you know, for value adds in specific projects, things that maybe you would stick away from. What would be one or two mistakes from a design strategy perspective that you see a fix and flip renovation? Someone who's going to sell that place retail, what are common mistakes that you perhaps have seen that have like dramatically impacted value in a negative way?
They just spend too much money than is needed. I'm going to rephrase a question by saying, I'm going to give you two tips that I think that people should do in order to maximize the amount of money that they can make on a flip. Number one is the best bang for your buck is definitely landscaping, curb appeal. There was a real estate agent, an elderly lady that I got to know early on in my life that was instrumental in a lot of great successful real estate deals. And one of the things she kept saying to me is, Van, you can't sell the steak without the sizzle. You can't sell the steak without the sizzle. And so what that means is that when you drive up to a property, you've got the first 5-10 seconds to really to make an impression on that potential purchaser. And you got to be able to, whether it's painting a garage door, whether it's throwing, you know, replacing the sod, planting some flowers, cleaning the place up front. Curb appeal is such a huge ROI factor that is often misunderstood and not utilized properly. People run out and immediately spend tens of thousands of dollars on kitchens and bathrooms. And yes, they do provide value, but the biggest bang for your buck is the outside landscaping. Another thing that I also find, especially when you get into these older homes, you know, the homes of circa, you know, 1950s, 1960s, where they have this big old room with this one little light fixture right in the middle of the room. And oftentimes, again, on a budget, try to maximize ROI, simply just replacing the light bulbs in those fixtures from 40 watt, 60 watt, all the way up to 120. Now with these LED lights, you could put a 5,000 watt like light bulb in there and won't cause any harm. But just by increasing the lighting of a particular room, all of a sudden, it just gives you a different perspective on the place. And just those simple little tricks that you learn over a period of time is one of the things that, you know, that I do, that I've picked up along the way, are just this most, you know, a couple thousand dollars all of a sudden dramatically increases the potential for you to be able to make real serious money. And obviously, of course, other things you can do in the property, but those cost more money. But hopefully that makes any that makes sense.
It does. I mean, I cringe because I know that it's probably not happening on every one of our flips now. But when I was the guy who was actually inspecting each flip and going in there and kind of managing the contracts and everything, light bulbs was one of my biggest things. You know, I would spend and get the GE reveal bulbs because the quality of the light would make the paint pop that much more. And it probably cost, I don't know, another 120 bucks for all the light bulbs in the whole house. And the other thing I would do is like when we would put the blinds in, I wouldn't have the contractor would leave this blind, you know, this way, the other blinds all the way down, or, you know, it's just they're adjusted differently. I'd go through and I'd adjust all of them like just perfect so that the light was always coming through at just the right angle to kind of give you that presentation value. I mean, it's like wiping the hardwood floors between showings to make sure you don't have footprints in there, you know, during the snow. I mean, there's just this attention to detail that when you're flipping houses, like you must absolutely remember to look at it through the eyes of that buyer for the first time, not the rehabber who is sick and tired of visiting the project because they've owned it for 3, 6, 7 months, 8 months, whatever it took to get it done. Cool. So are there any things I forgot to ask as we kind of get to our wrap up here, Van, that you feel like we should add before we get to our closing questions?
I actually just in terms of one of the things that I find a lot of acrimony that's created between the principal, the property owner, and the trades, the contractor, is part of that whole process of identifying the people that you want to do business with, that you need to really have a serious and unencumbered conversation about scheduling and about payment schedule. You got to get that out in the open. You got to establish that. You got to clear that up. And one of the things that I find often is just one of the things that is tucked off to the corner, swept under the rug. The principal doesn't want to talk about it. And then the contractor, tradesperson doesn't want to talk about it. But you should be up there up front in establishing what it is. What are the milestones that you need to reach? And how they're going to get paid, when are they going to get paid? And if you don't have that conversation, have that put in writing, it's a recipe for disaster. Because me as a contractor, speaking as one, you know, put my hat on as a contractor, my business always, I'm always trying to get as much money as I can, as possible from you up front. So whether that's prior to the starting of the job, and as we go throughout the job, unless I really know you and feel confident we have an established business relationship, if you're new, I'm going to try to extract as much money as I can quickly as possible from you. And you should need to resist that temptation, that pushing, and try to keep as much money as in your pocket. And one of the things I struggle with understanding is people will give so much money up front on to secure the services of a contractor or tradesperson to the point where it's like, you know, the only place that I give money up front is when I go to it's a McDonald's and I buy my hamburger. That's when you give money up front and then you wait around for a hamburger to be prepared. Why is it that real estate investors, you know, homeowners are giving so much money up front to a contractor, tradesperson when they're having delivered a service? I understand if you need to give money up front for the purchase of material, but that even in itself, you should be able to do on your own. Meaning if he's got a trade account, go over there, you buy the material. And once you buy it, in terms of the legality, if you bought it, that means it's your material. Versus if you bought it through a contractor that you've given or a tradesperson given money to, then there's a gray area there because you actually really haven't purchased the material. It's the tradesperson. So if they would decide to skip out and leave and grab the material, you have no right to it. You got to sue them. But if you purchase the material with your own credit card, with your own money, then it's your material. You're the legal owner of that material. So I strongly encourage people in setting up a payment schedule and also might be mindful of the amount of money you give your tradespeople, especially toward the end. We always, the last 5-10% of a rehab project, a renovation project are the most difficult. You see the light at the end of the tunnel, but there's so many little doodads of here and there and there. It's the devil's in the detail. And tradespeople, contractors, they just, if they got a lot of their money up front already, they're going to skedaddle. They're going to leave you. And then you're going to have to now figure out how to finish these little doodads by virtue of you keeping a lot of the money still in your pocket and forcing them, requiring them to finish everything and then paying them. That's how you keep control. And that's one of the things that people scratch their head to wonder, how is it that I keep the tradesperson, this contractor here on my job site? How is it that I get them to show up on time? Well, don't, you know, keep your money in your pocket. Trust me, if you owe them money, they will show up. So nice. That's all the only last thing I really wanted to add, because I find it, I'm really frustrated by, especially nowadays, there's this sort of thing now, all of a sudden contractors are demanding, you know, 20, 50%. I've heard some outrageous sums of money to secure their services. And like, wait a minute here, this is not McDonald's. So that's what I wanted to add.
Is there a book or two you'd recommend to our audience, Van?
I really love The Secrets of a Millionaire Mind by T. Harv Eker. It's a fabulous book, and I truly really recommend people reading it. I read it a number of years ago, and every so often I'll read it again. I think it's a fabulous book that teaches you mindset, and I strongly encourage it. Another one is Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Another great book, an all-time classic. Again, positive mindset. It's amazing what mindset can do. I'm a real huge proponent of it. And the last thing is The Wealthy Barber by Dave Chilton. A great little book. It really gives you an idea of an understanding of how passive income and how looking after your finances, how you're able to springboard from here to here, you know, to go up to the next level. So those are the three books that when people have asked me, those are the three books that have actually made an impact. There's a lot of books out there, a lot of podcasts, a lot of information. You just got to be willing to put in the time and effort.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. So my final question for you would be the crown jewel of wisdom, right? The REI Diamond Show, the diamonds is for diamonds in the rough for rehabbing. But for us on the show, it's kind of the crown jewel, right? This is all about wisdom. That's why we do the podcast. So if you had to go back with no money, starting it all over again, 20, 30 years ago, whenever it was, what would you tell yourself, knowing everything you know now, to yourself then, to kind of get started again from zero?
Dan, if I had to do it all over again, and what I recommend everybody is that I would definitely be making an investment in myself versus before I make an investment in anything tangible, whether it's real estate, stocks, whatever. Make the investment in yourself. And what does that mean is that you need to make the investment in time. You need to make the investment in education. You need to make the investment perhaps in a coach or a mentor. You got to get out there. And I akin it to learning how to play a musical instrument, like learning how to play the guitar. Yes, you can grab up a guitar and start strumming it and trying to figure it out on your own. In a couple of years, you might eventually figure out how to, you know, put a chord together. But isn't it so much more helpful to hire a guitar instructor, somebody that can sit right beside you, show you what how to hold a guitar, how to play the guitar. If you make a mistake, whack you upside the head, make sure that you know what you're doing, you know, to show you how to do it. It is the fastest, most secured way of getting you from point A to point Z. It's going out there and finding individuals, finding people, educating yourself, making an investment in yourself, because this business is very harsh. It's very difficult and it can be devastating. One wrong move in a renovation, one wrong move in buying a property that you shouldn't have can totally really devastate you financially and emotionally. And it's very difficult to overcome from that. So one of the things I stress is education, invest in yourself, is the first thing that I would be doing if I were to go into this. And really, once you've got that education, if you really, really want to get into the minutia, I think every good real estate investor should learn how to wholesale, should learn how to find deals off market. Because if you're running like the other millions of people onto MLS to try to find a deal, you're never going to find a deal. There are no deals on MLS. Money is made on the buy. And, you know, I couldn't emphasize that more. Money is made on the buy. So you got to buy properly. You got to find deals. And that is, once you find a deal, it's amazing how people, if you have a network of people created around you, if you found a deal, it's amazing how money pops up. There's jokers like me always looking for money to call partnership with people if they have the up, if they got a deal. And so you got to find the deals. Money's made on the buy. Hopefully that answers your question.
Nice. I love it. So how can listeners get more Van Sturgeon?
Well, I've got a website that I've created, vansturgeon.com. It's a website that I've written a number of articles on that have been published that are talking about real estate and renovation and how to invest properly. I've also been on a number of podcasts. I've got them on my website, as well as I've got a renovation calculator that I've developed. It took me several months with my team to put together. And essentially what this program does is that you go on my website, you enter your email, it gets sent to you. And what you do with this application is you just enter all the things that you want to do within that particular property. And it spits out a number. It gives you a budgetary number, what it is that you should be, what you should be looking at in terms of the renovation of a particular property. It's a great handy tool that people can use that I strongly encourage them to download. And that way they'll be able to use it and help them through the process of figuring out how much these things will cost. It's a great starter tool. So I encourage people to go on the website to get more information. And ultimately, if you want to contact me, you can do that through social media. I'm out there on Facebook and Instagram, as well as on my website. There's a contact page. I welcome any questions that you may have. And I love working with people that really are passionate and want to learn and want to become successful real estate because, hey, 90% of the world's multimillionaire billionaires are made out of real estate. And so it's a tried and true method. It's a power of leverage. It's a beautiful thing. So I encourage people to go out there, whether they want to, whether it's, there's lots of information out there. So I appreciate the time to be able to share it.
All right, cool. Hey, we are at the top. I really appreciate you coming on the show. Got a ton of notes here and had a good time. Thank you, Van.
Thank you very much for having me.
Low-cost capital is the fuel of any volume real estate investment business. As a real estate investor, I am sure you're well aware of these two facts. First, your business is driven by access to capital or starved from a lack thereof. And two, you make more money when you reduce the cost of said capital. Whether you're looking for hard money loans to fix and flip houses, rental portfolio loans, or even a line of credit, Lending Home offers the most competitive rates in the market, currently as low as 6.49%, which is good for fix and flip single family loans. I pay 10% myself at fundrehabdeals.com to my private investors. So at 6.49%, if you like that interest rate, go to reilineofcredit.com. Even if you're not currently in the market for a loan at this very minute, I encourage you to still go through that 1 minute sign up process right now so you can get on the email list. That way, once you're ready and you have a deal or a few, their name is top of mind. Plus, as a bonus for signing up through reilineofcredit.com, you'll receive a free iPad when you close your first loan. That's reilineofcredit.com. Thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. Interested in receiving my weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom that I discovered during the recording of the most recent episode? Sign up at reidiamonds.com. At that site, you can also access the 192 episode archive as well. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So in 2020, my house flipping business, Diamond Equity Investments, bought and sold 283 houses. And we've done 163 so far this year. well, mostly houses, a few were apartment buildings. And we currently have another 164 more in our inventory, either under construction or under contract and awaiting close. And I share all that to say this. There are three ways that you and I can do business. Number one, if you are interested in having access to the best real estate deals in your market, in other words, access to deals that you could buy at low enough prices to actually profit after renovating and reselling, go now to www.accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, accredited investors seeking double-digit returns can sign up for private mortgage investment opportunity emails regarding the funding of our deals at fundrehabdeals.com. That's how to passively participate in Diamond Equity Investments deals. And number three, finally, I am always buying houses that I can flip and always buying occupied apartment buildings that ideally have below market rents so that I have some upside. If you have a deal that fits that description in either Atlanta, Chicago, Phoenix, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, we have Johnny Wolf of Home Room joining us to share how you can own select rental properties in B neighborhoods that generate 70% above market rents. I'll catch you and Johnny on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.